You're listening to Unveiling Mormonism from PursueGod.org.
So, Brandy and AJ, I've heard you say the phrase grinding for godhood. I've actually never heard that before from a former Mormon. So why don't you explain that? What does that mean in your story when you guys were Mormons?
Well, Brian, I am a sucker for alliterations. So I love the phrase grinding for godhood. It just rolls off the tongue. But beyond that, there is some theological background to that. I feel like ever since I was a little girl, my whole purpose was to tap into my divine nature and to become a god. That was, I don't know, what about you, AJ? I felt like that was my entire purpose.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was funny. Growing up, I had a homemade sign in my bedroom. And it said, I'm going there someday. And it had a painting of the LDS temple on it. And I knew that getting to the temple was my goal. The temple unlocked my ability to reach exaltation and enjoy eternal increase. And so, oh my gosh, Brian, the amount of diary entries I have of my eternal companion that I'm going to find, and he's going to bring me through the temple. And that was everything for me, because I knew that's how I was going to become a god. And that was my purpose. So
now, this is a Mormon thing for people listening to this podcast for a while. They would understand this, but for any Christians who maybe just stumbled across this episode, they're probably saying, wait, Mormons believe that you're going to become a god? And and maybe even just drill down a little bit before we get into more of your story. Like, for a lot of people, that seemed more like a guy thing than a woman thing. So even Brandy, even you thought about being like heavenly mother someday, not just AJ being like a god of his own planet as the guy. Does that make sense?
Oh. Yeah, 100%. Yes, absolutely. I think it's hard for women a little bit more because Heavenly Mother is not spoken of. She's sacred, right? So we don't really speak of her. And I already knew that that was going to be my future. I knew that whatever posterity I had in the eternities wouldn't necessarily worship me, but I didn't care about being worshiped. I want to be clear. When I wanted godhood, it wasn't this self-obsessed thing, or at least it didn't feel that way. It wasn't like, I want everyone to worship me and bend the knee to me. It was more or less the fact that was who I was. My ontology was divine. I was made up of divine being in the Young Women's theme. It talks about our divine nature. And I quoted that every week in Young Women's. So I knew that that was who I was. And that was the future. The plan of the restoration and the plan of happiness was that I started off as a spirit child and that I could become all that Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ are. And so it was more of an obligation. It was like, this is what I was made for. It wasn't like, oh my goodness, this is so self-obsessed. It was, this is why I'm here. And I better take it seriously because Jesus died for this reason.
Did that make you the odd one out, or did you find a lot of other young women in your ward that kind of had the same goal for their eternity?
That's a great question. I don't think that anyone in my ward, I mean, I don't really remember having many specific conversations with other LDS friends about this as much as non-LDS friends trying to tell them about this plan of happiness. But in terms of like ladies in my ward, I don't think that anyone would have denied that that was their goal either. Nowadays, it's a little different. I think that LDS are kind of stepping back from this rhetoric, but it was well known and well discussed growing up that that was the goal.
AJ, was that the same in your ward? I'm assuming you guys didn't grow up as kids and young people in the same ward. So was this the same for you growing up, or was it a little bit more kind of laid back? Because this is Brandy's story, sounds really intense. Not every Mormon has that same story.
Yeah, Brandy grew up in California, the heathen out here, but yep. I was in the motherland, Salt Lake Valley. Mm. And yeah, for sure. That's the goal. There's really only one goal, and that's exaltation and living with your eternal family and kind of perpetuating the cycle.
Yeah.
So I've heard, by the way, that Utah Mormons are different. Is this say, yeah, can you guys speak to that? Because you've got a Utah Mormon and a California Mormon. So this is now starting to make more sense, Brandy. California non-Utah Mormons kind of have to be more bought in, right, to their beliefs and to their faith, because you're not in the motherland, you're not surrounded by Mormons.
Oh, totally. I was bumping up against not anti-Mormons, but those outside of my faith constantly. So I really had to know my stuff. But yeah, I mean, I would consider myself a true Mormon. I don't know. I feel like those Utah people have it too easy. They don't even have to wake up early for seminary like the rest of us. So
that's true. Yeah.
All right. Let's go back and tell your story. So back us up. We'll come to kind of how you came out of Mormonism in just a little bit, but tell your stories of growing up Mormon in California and or Utah.
Well, just like you said, in the motherland, I didn't have a lot of pushback on any of my beliefs. The majority of my high school were all LDS. In fact, I think the number was like over 90% were LDS. And so I had very few friends who weren't. And, you know, we were very, very involved, as most Mormons are in the church. So Sunday every week, seminary, mutual, every Wednesday, we were very involved in the callings, and we loved it. And so I didn't have a lot of pushback. I never really thought, you know, there was anything weird about it. And I loved every aspect of it.
Yeah. I grew up in a really interesting home because my dad had come from a family of 13 and my grandpa was a bishop and they grew up very Orthodox. While my mother was initially raised as a Methodist and she converted as an early teen. And so I had this really interesting mix. My dad was like kind of the reader and my mom was the feeler. So I feel like I had a good balance of like wanting to learn theology and having that be important, but then also really digging into the spiritual aspects of Mormonism. So I grew up in a family of six, just like AJ. And all, we went through the traditional steps, baptized when we were eight. I went through young women's, he went through young men's. And my whole life was really mapped out for me. I loved having all of these answers to life's questions. From a young age, I knew I'd be going to the temple after going to BYU and having a bunch of kids and driving a minivan. And all of that happened just the way that I had planned since I was a little girl. So while everyone else in high school was like trying to figure themselves out, I knew exactly who I was since the pre-existence. And I just felt really confident in all of that.
So was there anything at this point in your childhood into your junior high school days, anything that kind of was a question mark for you in Mormonism? I don't know if you can kind of remember back to those days. It sounds like you guys were both all in. I mean, there was no reason not to be all in.
For sure. I mean, you have small questions in your head that maybe bother you a little bit, like polygamy and the eternal regression of gods. Like, well, who's the main God? Who started the whole system? Oh, well, no one started it. It's been eternal. And you obviously can't wrap your head around that. So, but these were minuscule issues that you didn't focus on and didn't really bother you that much. I felt like I had spiritual confirmations and logical confirmations as well of the truthfulness of it all. It made sense. Why would it not be true?
AJ, yeah. Was there anyone for you in Utah? Was there anyone for you at like in high school or junior high that like pushed back? Maybe someone who was a Christian, a friend who was a Christian, who pushed back a little bit? Like at any point growing up in Utah, AJ, would you say that you got a sniff of maybe Mormonism isn't Christianity, like, I don't know, like maybe Mormons were saying?
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny you bring that up. I dated a girl very, very shortly, just prior to the mission, who was Christian. And she invited me to her church and I attended one Sunday and I invited her to mine. And I don't remember us really having discussions, a lot of theological discussions. And I don't remember attending the church and feeling like, oh, this is interesting. I didn't know this. Like, very close-minded, right? I had the truth. I knew I had the truth. No reason to even like look into this. So even though, yeah, I did have someone kind of introduce, again, we didn't really prod at each other's beliefs too much. It was, you know, a very short stint of us dating anyway, right before the mission. And I was too close-minded to even ask any questions. Mm.
So, Brandy, your story has got to be different because you're growing up in California, not Utah. Right. So you certainly had Christians all the time, I would imagine, like challenging your Mormonism, maybe even some Christians saying that you're part of a cult.
Oh, yes. I got that all the time. Mm. And people would ask me in the morning, they're like, do you go to a cemetery? And I'm like, no, it's seminary. It's not a cemetery. They're like, you Mormons are weird. I'm like, I love it. I actually loved being different. Most of my friends were non-LDS. Which actually, Brian, made things a little weird in my ward too, because I was kind of misunderstood in the secular world, but then also in Mormon land, because people were like, why are you, you know, back in the day, LDS were a lot more clicky. And I even have a story. I'm going to back up for a second. My mom had an experience one time with a man. He found out that she was a Latter-day Saint and was like, wait, you're a Mormon? She's like, yeah, what's up? And he was like, well, usually Latter-day Saints stick to themselves. Like they're really kind of clicky. And she was like, what? You know, she came home and she was thinking about it and she even told me about it. And she was like, I think that he's probably right that we have a problem in the church of being very close-minded, very clicky, but I don't think that's how it's supposed to be. I don't think that's how Jesus would want it to be. And I remember her having that conversation with me and it really affected me. And I had this perspective that I was going to be like Paul, the apostle to the Gentiles, and go out into the world and every Mormon a missionary. And the I Am a Mormon campaign was super hot and heavy when I was in high school. So I was very confident in that. And I made a point to have non-LDS friends, and I would debate the Trinity. I would have friends. We had a debate group. I was very active in wanting to discuss these things with people. And like AJ, not once did I consider any other way. I did these as a formality, like, what do you think? And I would just wait for them to stop talking so that I could tell them about the restoration, because we had extra biblical sources. We had a prophet. We had all of these things that were biblical that Christianity had lost in the apostasy. And so I just was very, very sure about all of those things and wanted to share that with the world. I went to the ward clerk and I was like, get me as many Book of Mormons as you can. And he mustered up about, I don't know, 15. And I wrote my testimony in all of them and highlighted my favorite scriptures and gave them to all of my friends, my very close friends when I graduated, and some teachers. And so my old broadcasting teacher still has my Book of Mormon. And I've had some pretty awkward conversations with people since then. I'm like, hey, do you still have that thing? But I thought it was a beautiful expression of love to tell people about the restored gospel.
So Brandy, was there anything in those early years, in those zealous years, anything that was like a little bit of a yellow flag for you in Mormonism?
Well, the only thing I question sometimes, well, okay, when I was young, there were a couple of things as I got older, specifically surrounding polygamy. But when I was young, I just always had this question in my head, like, how can it be that such a tiny fraction of people are LDS, but it's the only true church? And even if we did temple work for the entire millennium, like statistically, how are we going to get everybody in? And so I kind of wondered sometimes, just being such a minority, that I don't know, maybe that was, maybe that's not even good logic, but at that time I really wondered how we were going to make sure everybody really was saved.
But you were going to be a part of it, by gosh darn it, right? I mean, it sounds 100%. Like, yeah.
Yes. I was promised to be one of the first people in my patriarchal blessing. I was promised to be one of the first people on the morning of the first resurrection to see that off. So I took that seriously.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So I can't even imagine. I can't wait to hear the rest of your story, Brandy. I'm sure our listeners are at the edge of their seats, because you just sound like someone who, you were so in it to win it. And I know that Bo and KD, when they shared their story, KD just said she just then at this point, she just needed to find a worthy husband. Was that your mentality? You were like,
100%.
Yeah, because your eternity, correct me if I'm wrong, in Mormonism, did you understand it like this, that your eternity would be connected then to whoever you married? Like, there's a ceiling there that's an eternal thing, so that it kind of makes the stakes super, super high for you probably picking a college, for example.
Yeah, exactly. I knew I needed to go to BYU because that's where, and I wanted to go to BYU Provo because that's like the cream of the crop priesthood boys. And that is where that would, and my whole goals were set on that. So absolutely. There's actually a quote by Joseph Fielding Smith that says, the gift promised to those who receive this covenant of marriage and remain faithful to the end, that they shall have no end, means that they shall have the power of eternal increase. Only those who have this power will truly know the only wise and true God and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent. Others may see the Lord and may be instructed by him, but they will not truly know him or his Father unless they become like him. So I needed a man. I needed someone to take me through the temple, and I needed to be sealed in order to truly know God and to become like him. So yeah, that was everything to me.
Okay. So then you get down, you make it, congratulations, you get accepted into BYU Provo. Mm-hmm. You get down there and there's this hot, good looking, smart, right?
Now we're talking.
Now
it was purely contractual, bro.
So like, how soon, AJ, you were down there at the same time, it sounds like?
Yeah. So I did my LDS mission in Barcelona, which I absolutely loved. I took it very seriously, and it means a lot to me still. Mm. And I met a guy on that mission, another missionary in my mission, and came back to, after we finished up, we were at BYU and I saw him. And it ended up being Brandy's brother. So Brandy's brother and I served in Barcelona together and reconnected at BYU. And that's where I met Brandy.
Yep.
So, okay. Now let's talk about the dating scene at BYU. Is it like a total meat market? Like, all these good Mormon girls are trying to find worthy husbands. And there's lots of guys that are maybe thinking about that, but maybe also more carnal. Do I have it somewhat correct? Or am I giving the girls too much credit?
No, it's fierce out there. The competition is something else. And everybody's trying to get a ring on their finger. I remember being a junior Okay. Cause I got married the year I was graduate. I tried. Okay. This is so silly, Brian, but I wanted to be different than all the other girls. I wanted to wait until after BYU, after I finished my degree, to get married. But I also wanted to lock down a man before I left BYU. So I wanted to have this, like, I knew who I was going to marry. I found the guy, but I'm not going to conform to the standard of meeting a guy in biology and getting married in the same semester. Like, I wanted to be a little bit, you know, I'm from California. I need to do it a little differently. So I had these weird arbitrary rules in my head. And I remember talking to this girl at the BYU broadcast center, and she just had this look of distress on her. And I was like, are you worried that you're not going to find somebody before you leave? Like, I just already knew what it was about. I didn't even know her. And she was like, yeah. And I was like, me too. Like, I'm so stressed out. Mm. Like, I keep going on dates, and you're going on 20 dates a week. Like, it's like, meet someone for lunch, go out to dinner, and then you're, you know, going to the study hall with somebody, and you're just trying so hard to find the right person before your time runs out. And being a junior, most of my roommates had already been married off. My original, like, all of us six were, most of them were already married off. So I felt like an old seasoned woman at the ripe old age of 20. And I was like, it's never going to happen for me.
Wait,
like,
hold on a second. Wait, so you're telling me, help me with the culture of BYU. You're telling me that that freshmen are already thinking, you're 18 years old.
Yeah.
And you're already like, it is just like a mad rush to find your husband.
Yes.
Yeah.
100%. Wow. There were freshmen that I knew that got married.
Wow.
That year, like, didn't even end their first year and were already married. Of course, they had married a return missionary, not somebody like in our ward. After dating for a couple of weeks, okay, they would be engaged. Wow. I actually
that's an
knew
extreme
somebody.
Example.
Yes.
Yeah. That does happen.
It does happen. And I would say to be single as a senior is scary. You don't want to end up there.
Wow. So you really had, as a junior now, the pressure is definitely on.
Oh yeah. The time was ticking and I felt it with every minute. I felt it. So I was really lucky because I was headed home for Christmas break and it was my junior year and I had just decided that I was going to give up. I was like, you know what? Never mind. I guess I'm too eccentric. I'm not the quiet little one. I don't know. I just felt like I didn't really fit the mold that many of these boys were looking for. But then I was headed home and my brother, of course, because he's my brother, I was like, hey, you got somebody to take us home, like on the train, right? So we can hit the airport and get home to California for Christmas. And he's like, oh no, I actually forgot. And I'm like, okay, well, everybody's already home. Finals have passed. Like, what are we going to do? He's like, I'll call up my buddy AJ. And so he called AJ up and he shows up in a truck and drives us to the train station. And I was like, okay. So, I mean,
he's got most of his teeth. I mean,
he's got most of his teeth. You know what, Brian? He was wearing a very low V-neck. I don't even know how he passed that with garments because, and there was like, I mean, you know, he had a very low V-neck and very tight pants because he was still in his European phase, his European era from his mission. And I was like, it's not quite my vibe, but I'm, you know, I like that he made me laugh and
stuff.
It was a great look. You still have do you still have those pants, AJ, by the way?
Okay. No, I don't. You know what? It's funny. I think we only got rid of them like a year or two ago.
Yeah, it was hard for him to get rid of those.
I haven't worn them in 10 years, but.
Yeah, he weeped when we donated those. Yeah,
those were they were straight from Barcelona.
Yeah. Good times. But yeah, I was like, this guy's really nice and he could handle my eccentric nature. And he also had an eccentric nature. And so it was fun. And so I told my brother, I was like, hey, I'd like to like know more about, you know, this guy. And he's like, oh, he's already been texting me asking if he could take you out. And I was cool. What? So yeah. So that was really great. So we started dating and that same year we were sealed in the LDS temple in Sacramento.
Oh my goodness. Now, AJ, back us up from your perspective, from a guy at BYU, you're a return missionary. So is it as much, I would imagine it's not as much pressure on you because the ball's more in your court, right?
The ball is definitely more in your court, but I would say that there's a decent amount of pressure. I remember my exit interview with my mission president, and he said, this is now your mission to go and find yourself a wife. Like, that's the most important thing you can do for your life right now. So I would say the pressure's still on to a certain degree, but certainly, yeah, the ball's in your court and you get a call of shots. So, yep.
Okay. So you guys finally, Brandy, you finally make it, right? You get the MRS degree and then, so then you guys graduate from BYU. What happens next in your story? I mean, to me, it sounds like a story that is like, you're going to ride happily ever after into the sunset toward your planet. But what happened?
Well, I want to mention one thing, Brian, back up a little bit. When you're engaged to be married, we would both be just very afraid that something catastrophic would happen to one of us prior to the sealing. Like, hey, we've got to hurry and get sealed so that we can be together in eternity. Like if you just drop dead, like I'm screwed. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the pressure's on, and that was something that we both felt
all the time. I was always constantly worried. I had this countdown on my phone until sealing day, and I was so worried that something bad was going to happen to him because I'd have to start the whole process over again. And I wanted him to be my eternal companion. Mm. But yeah, we felt like we made it. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you, Brian, the wards that you go to when you're newly married. So it's just a bunch of young married people showing off their rings. There is no greater flex than having a ring on your finger and showing up. And, you know, now I had garments, I got married, and I went through that process. And my mom, I remember coming home, especially once we had our first baby, came home to California, and it was like showing me off to the ward, right? Like, she did it. She got the ring, and she has the husband, and she got through the temple, and she has a baby. And there's so much to that. And it just felt really great to have finally like made it.
So wait, back up a second. You just said something that some of our non-Mormon listeners wouldn't understand. You said now you had a ring and you had garments. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I had, in order to get sealed in the temple, I had to be endowed. And that process in the temple requires that you get your holy garment and then you commit to wearing it both day and night from then on, once you're endowed. AJ had already gone through his endowment before he went on a mission. Mm. So missionaries go through that process beforehand, but I never served a mission. So I had to actually go through that process on Black Friday. I went and got my garments and went through my own endowment session. And then we could get sealed the next month. And I was wearing garments that whole time until I got married. But I'd always wanted to wear garments. I was so excited. I mean, I did not like wearing them when I finally was able to wear them, but I saw my parents wearing them my whole life. And it just was like, oh, I cannot wait until I have my own husband and my own garments. And
okay. So wait, I'm confused. I thought you you were an intense, like all in Mormon. Could you not have gone through the endowment in like California before you went to BYU? Or does that have to be connected to marriage for someone like you?
Yeah. It's not very standard for a woman to go through the temple unless there is a marriage or a mission. I mean, technically, I think women can just go through electively, but that is so uncommon. Mm. And they actually changed the rules. So when I was in college, I was 19 when at General Conference, they released the information that they were going to lower the age for girls to serve missions.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm 19. Like, was this for me? Like I was serving at the MTC. I thought maybe I was going to go on a mission, but then I decided, no, I really need to get married. That needs to be my goal. Mm. But at that point, I was really, you know, just waiting until I was married to get those garments. Yeah.
Because before that, what was the age where women would go?
21.
21. And tell me what was the reason for 21?
I honestly think it was just because they wanted most women to get married and they didn't want them going on missions. Yeah.
Okay. So let's clarify that. So the rule when you were 18, the rule was 21. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea is, AJ, maybe you can help us with this, because Utah Mormons feel the pressure more than anyone probably, is boys would be expected to go on a mission at 18 or 19, right? Right out of high school. Is that correct?
Yeah.
But girls at that time, AJ, for you, the girls, it was only once you were 21. And tell me if I'm overstating this, but it's basically saying, you've got a few years to find your husband. And if you don't, your punishment is you have to go on a mission.
Well, I think the goal is definitely to find your eternal companion. And maybe if you don't in that time, maybe it's, you know, you can serve and then come back and then look again.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't really know beyond the fact that you would know that if a girl goes on her mission at that point, it became cool. Once they changed the age to 19, it was like, cool, girls were going on missions. But before, there was kind of this really sad, you know, aura about like, oh, I failed at finding a spouse. Now I've been rejected kind of, and I'm going to go serve a mission instead. And that being my contribution right now. And that was the stigma, regardless of whether or not that was kind or Christ-like, that is what was felt, is that like, you know, you best be finding somebody before that 21 year mark. So,
okay. So now we're caught up to, okay, you guys, oh, by the way, you said the MTC, explain what the MTC is and what was it like? Maybe AJ, you explain the MTC, and then Brandy, you explain maybe some of the cultural, idiosyncrasies of the MTC.
The MTC is the Missionary Training Center. It's located in Provo next to BYU. They actually have a number of them now. But the majority of people will go there, and that's where you kind of learn how you're going to preach the gospel. So you're given courses every day. It's very rigorous. The, you know, your day starts and almost every minute is accounted for, and you basically attend courses. So for me going to Barcelona, I had a teacher that would teach us Spanish. Then they would teach us the lessons in Spanish, the lessons that we would give to, you know, potential investigators, and just prepare you for the mission. You learn the rules, you learn the language, and you learn the lessons.
And so you went to the MTC AJ when you graduated from high school and you got your calling, and you didn't get to choose where to go. It was correct. Chosen for you, right? It's a big, like, it's kind of a big reveal, right? In high school.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I got the jackpot there with Barcelona.
Yeah. Okay. So how long were you at the MTC, AJ?
I was a little longer because we were waiting for visas. The four of us that were going to go to Barcelona, Spain was slow and delayed in getting us our visas. So I was there over 3 months, almost 3.5 months, which is a little unusual. Usually if you're going to wait that long for a visa, they will reassign you stateside mission just for until your visa comes in, and then you'll go. So the four of us that were supposed to go to Barcelona, we stayed for quite a while and became home.
And do you stay there? Do you live there like in dorms yeah. when you're in the MTC?
Correct.
Yeah, and exactly. How many other students are a part of that? Is it like an incoming class that you're all the same, or is it just like there's always new kids coming in every week?
I think almost every week. I don't know the details on that, but it there's a lot of people there. And yeah, so you're broken up into like districts and zones and things like that. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but there were four of us going to Barcelona, and then probably around 12 of us in our district total. And then there's zones that encompass multiple districts. And so I couldn't even tell you a number of missionaries there. It's a lot. And it's just a constant inflow and, you know, outflow of missionaries.
But for both of you guys, this kind of organization must have just reinforced your belief in Mormonism. Because you're, especially for you, Brandy, now you're surrounded by Mormons. I mean, it's so different. Provo is a little different than California. You're surrounded by Mormons now. Everyone's Mormon. You're working at the MTC. You get to interact, I'm sure, with missionaries who are getting ready to go all around the world. It has to be, I would imagine, like almost exhilarating to be a part of this. And Brandy, given especially your excitement and buy-in before this, like did your time in Provo only make you more Mormon than ever?
Yeah, it did make me more Mormon than ever. My sister even said something once. She was like, wow, you come back from Christmas break just a lot. But I think also, and this kind of speaks to me being raised in California, but I actually saw a lot of uglier sides to Utah culture when I was at BYU because it was so foreign to me. I show up in this place and everyone has the same beliefs that I do. And it became very legalistic. It became, you know, obviously you have to follow the honor code at BYU and there's a lot of rules. And I was happy to do all of those things. But it just seemed like everybody was focused on so much superficiality and everything seemed to be oriented horizontally instead of vertically. And I actually really felt grossed out about that. I'd call my mom all the time and be like, I don't feel Jesus here a lot. And it was her who really made me feel like that was the whole point, right? Is Jesus. And so I thought that. And so I actually had problems with Utah culture and I would talk about it all the time. And I'm like, everybody just seems to be really, you know, perfection spiritually, but also physically. On the surface level, we're supposed to look a certain way and we can't talk about our shortcomings and none of that. So I felt kind of suffocated at BYU a lot of the times because of that. I felt like I couldn't be very honest and just as free. I felt very suffocated. But at the same time, my love for the Restoration and the Book of Mormon and the gospel grew so intensely. Like I was taking BYU courses and I was taking courses on theology in general. And I fell in love with the Restoration and Joseph Smith, and I revered him so much greater. And I learned about really unique parts of the Book of Mormon. And so I would walk around the Provo Temple that was right next to the MTC a lot and just listen to conference talks. And I didn't really get to visit the Sacramento Temple a lot. We didn't really do that as a family growing up. So when I went out to BYU Provo, my roommate showed me really a lot of around the temple and baptisms for the dead and doing that more. And I grew in my faith in a lot of ways, but I also felt very repulsed by legalism. And I thought, funny enough, I can see now that I was still very much checking boxes and I felt pressured to do that. But at the time I thought, well, I'm going to live the higher law. Like I see the reason behind all of this. Right. And so I even felt better than the Mormons because I thought they were trapped in these little boxes and I was above all of them.
But so for sure, the grind for godhood was still on.
Oh, for sure. That's exactly. At the end of the day, as much as I love the gospel and as much as I wanted to live that higher law and really know the why behind the rules, I knew that I needed to follow the rules and I knew that I needed to get where I needed to go and that it was on me. There's even a quote from the late LDS prophet, Russell L. Nelson. And he says, his hope for us, his meaning Heavenly Father's hope for us is eternal life. And we qualify for it by obedience to covenants and ordinances of the temple. For ourselves, our families, and our ancestors, we cannot be made perfect without them. We cannot wish our way into the presence of God. We are to obey the laws upon which those blessings are predicated. I very much agreed with that worldview. And I still felt that pressure for sure.
Okay. So I can't imagine how someone, a couple like you two, finds your way out of Mormonism. How did God tell your story then? And how did God start unveiling Mormonism for people like you who were just so clear? Because we hear this all the time that people are like, oh, you just left Mormonism because you want to drink coffee or you want to drink beer or because you weren't really all in. Right. But you guys, that's not true for you guys. You guys were all in and so were your families.
Absolutely all in. And we loved every aspect of it. And even during the midst of, and we'll get into kind of what the cracks were, but even while we were studying the historical and doctrinal issues of the church, it was hurtful. We wanted it to be true. We wanted it to, how do we make this make sense? How do we make it work? Because our intent wasn't, let's find the easiest way out. Oh, there's the little crack. Yeah, I'm done. To the contrary, it was very much, we loved it. This is our identity. We need this to be true. How do we make it work? So kind of going back, I would say, I'm fresh off the mission on a spiritual high, absolutely love the gospel. And at BYU, actually in a religion course, this might've been my first or second semester at BYU in a religion course. And a student raises his hand and asks the teacher about blood atonement. And I had never heard of this before. And I kind of read the teacher's face and he quickly dismissed, I don't remember what he said, but I remember him kind of quickly dismissing that and moving on. And I wrote that down in my notes, like blood atonement, what the heck is that? I've grown up Mormon. I've done seminary. I just came off my mission where I was preaching. Like I thought I knew everything about Mormonism, right? Like there's nothing that there's no concept that I haven't heard before. And so it was astonishing, like blood atonement, what is this? So I went back and researched it, and just for the listeners that aren't aware, it's basically a teaching that there are some sins too great. The atonement of Christ doesn't cover them. You've got to spill your own blood, essentially. I don't know that there's even any evidence that was ever practiced, but the fact that it was taught from the pulpit was just a huge blow to me. I would say I absolutely still maintained my full testimony. I believed in the church. I couldn't deny these spiritual experiences I had. From my mission, I had what I thought, the logic behind belief, but I could no longer say the prophet won't lead you astray because I had a clear example of that occurring right here. And it forced me to be more nuanced in my approach with the church. Before I was just very black and white, right? I was known as a very stringent missionary, very strict with the rules. And to me, everything was just pretty black and white. And this forced me to be much more nuanced and kind of like Brandy, like, well, what's the intent kind of behind this? And I would say that is absolutely the first and a very large crack that was formed within me.
That's interesting. So you had never heard of blood atonement before, never. And you learned about it at BYU.
Yes.
Did I miss this? Was it from a professor or from just your own research?
It was from another student in the class, it was a Book of Mormon class. It really had nothing to do with it. I think the student, now thinking back, maybe had discovered some things, maybe was questioning his own testimony, but asked the professor about it just kind of out of the blue. And reading the professor's response, his facial expressions, I was like, ooh, he kind of touched on a source of, what is that? I've never heard of that. And then went home and researched it.
By the way, I'd love to have you guys on another time and let's tackle this topic. This would be a great topic because our listeners probably are like, what are you talking? I don't even know what you're talking about. So this will be a good little teaser for a future episode.
For sure.
Brandy, what about you? Like, did you, so, well, AJ, were you guys married or dating at this point, or was this even before you guys?
No, this is before I even met Brandy.
So yeah. did you bring like something like this? Would you have brought something like this into Brandy once you guys did meet and start dating?
You know, I want to emphasize I was still fully in it.
Yeah.
I just, again, had to take a much more nuanced approach. And yeah, we discussed things. I don't know that we ever discussed blood atonement, but.
No, it wasn't until later that he brought that up. And honestly, if I had known that there was cracks, you know, on the shelf, I would have jumped ship a long time ago.
Steer clear. Yeah.
Steer clear. So like, I don't care how tight your pants are. You've got cracks in your foundation.
Exactly. No, he didn't really discuss those things with me because, again, I think that that was just something that Mormons, specifically when you're inundated with this messaging your whole life, what you do very quickly is you doubt your doubts and not your faith, and you shove it in the way back, right? So I think it's something that we didn't really discuss because it wasn't at the forefront of his brain. You just look at it and you're like, oh, that's weird. And then, but this is what I do know. Yeah. And then we'll just move on kind of thing. Right.
So then what happened? So you guys get married, you guys finish up at BYU, you end up, did you stay in Utah for a while or did you come to California pretty quickly after graduation?
Pretty quickly after graduation.
Okay. We moved out. He had to finish his master's. So we had one child at that point when he was getting his master's. And then when he finished that up, we moved out here. And then I had our last two babies out in California. Mm. So that whole time he had an interesting career change because he went through the academy, and had to live in a camper once he was stationed in his first, city. And so he would only come home on the weekends, and those weekends on shift work aren't always on the weekend. So I would go to church a lot by myself, and I was either sick and pregnant or had a bunch of newborns. And so it was really hard for me to fully integrate into the word. But I did the best that I could. I went to my parents' ward a lot. But at that time I did feel like there was so much shifting in the church. And I know that the church is still shifting quite a bit right now, but at that time, specifically for me, I'm very pro-life, very, very pro-life. And I was having issues. I felt like the LDS church was becoming a little bit more moderate on their position. And at this time I was on the website, the LDS.org website. And they're, position on euthanasia, which is, you know, you should never take a life early for any reason, medical or otherwise, contradicted their moderate position on abortion. And so I saw a contradiction in their policy, and I felt like, you know what, they need to hear about this. I'm going to write a letter. And Mormons are so good at mobilizing. And if the prophet or a leader, an ecclesiastical leader, says, hey, we're going to create this new calling and we're going to, you know, go out and we're going to do this, they will do it. Mormons will work so hard because, you know, they love their leaders and they love to work hard. And so I thought, wow, what if we had a calling in every ward where someone was heading up a pro-life clinic or something where we could help women choose life and go into high schools and universities and help them with their prenatal appointments or figure out an adoption agency or do something. I felt like there was so much that I kept saying to my mom all the time, like, if Jesus were running this show, if he really were running this church, you think that we would hear more about this over the pulpit because this is a genocide of the unborn. And that really was the genesis of my disaffection with the current leadership. And again, at this point, I was not questioning the validity of the Restoration or the Book of Mormon or Joseph Smith. It was just, what the heck is going on right now? Why are our prophets talking about things that we felt were contradicting our biblical values? 2020 was weird. 2021 was even weirder. And so we just felt like they kept publicly endorsing organizations and financially supporting organizations that went against our biblical values. And we don't really need to get into what those are, but it was very frustrating for us at that point. So
why do you guys think you had, it's interesting to hear you say as Mormons, you had biblical values. So did you guys, I mean, this is a legitimate question I have for like Mormons in general. Maybe you guys could answer this for Utah Mormons and versus non-Utah Mormons. But I've always been of the opinion, and I think it's playing out, that Mormonism is going to go the way of some of these other institutional Christian denominations, these mainline denominations like Lutherans and Methodists and whatever, where some people in the church are committed to the Bible, but most of the people in the church are just like cultural Christians, or in Mormonism's case, cultural Mormons. And so there's just been these issues with LGBT and abortion and whatever else that these, you know, Lutheran church is split, where you've got the evangelical branch, which these are Bible believing people with biblical values. And then you have the mainline branch. And in a lot of these churches, the larger branch is the progressive branch, the non-biblical branch, throw out the Bible. But I've always felt like that crisis is going to hit Mormonism. And I feel like it's hit since COVID.
Yep.
And I'm just really surprised whenever I hear a story like yours, where you guys have biblical values, because Mormonism doesn't really elevate the Bible. So I would imagine in Mormonism, most people will just say, whatever, yeah, let's just go the way of the culture. And so it's going to get even further away from traditional family and Bible values.
Yeah, I see that shift happening a lot too. I would say from AJ's and my generation, though, it was very conservative. Mm. I thought all Latter-day Saints were conservative. I hadn't even met a progressive Latter-day Saint until I went to college. And I was like, wait, you exist? Because for me, Mormonism was conservatism. It was mixed together. You couldn't have an 1820 without a 1776, right? Mm. Like, America existed for the restoration. The Garden of Eden was here in the United States. This is where Jesus was going to come back, you know, and so everything for us, I thought that I grew up very conservative and a very American centric. And that was tied to the restoration in my mind and in my family culture and in my work. And so I didn't even know any different. And I didn't know the Bible well. I really disliked the Old Testament, to be honest with you. Mm. I didn't even know who Paul was when I was LDS. Mm. It was only, I had to learn a lot after leaving the LDS church, but I didn't really read my Bible. I considered it to be a kind of a dead word, right? And it was transmitted wrong and it was translated incorrectly. And so there were all these issues where I didn't trust it at all. And I was looking to the fresh words of, you know, the living oracle, the prophet. But I did know the Ten Commandments. I did know the general sense of what God commanded. And because I felt and was under the law, I wanted to keep the commandments. I made covenants to keep those commandments all the time, like in sacrament meeting. So those were so important.
Your commitment to conservative values was more about your commitment to probably like family values versus biblical values. It wasn't like you trusted the Bible and you're going to stand with the Bible. It was more like, wait a second, Mormons have always had traditional family values. We can't just change that, even though technically Mormons can, because like you just said, the living prophet could change it whenever he wanted to. Now, not that they have quite, they probably haven't come out so boldly to change it, but I do think we're heading toward that day.
Yeah. Yeah. AJ and I were the old school Mormons where we didn't think that would ever change or could ever change. And that the living prophet wasn't someone who could contradict prior revelation. He could just add line upon line. It was like that analogy where you're slowly turning on the light and the next prophet goes, oh, there's the lamp. And then the next light comes on. Oh, and then there's a sofa over there. And slowly and we get to the point where we have more revelation and more knowledge of God. But I never would have bought the idea that a prophet could contradict something that another prophet had already done. And that is why AJ was having so many issues with blood atonement. And I didn't know any issues with theology. At this point, my disaffection was just with the current leadership of the church. Mm. It wasn't until, and I don't know if you want to get here yet, but it wasn't until I started asking questions about why we were seeing so many changes, that we started to actually look into the historicity of Mormonism and the theological claims. And that's when everything really broke.
Yeah. I was struggling with the same things. Like, man, what's going on with our current leadership? It feels like it's like rogue. Like, I don't know. I reached out to an old, mission companion just to get things off my chest and be like, are you seeing what I'm seeing? Am I crazy about this? And I didn't know this. He had left the church and he's like, well, you might want to look at this document, and sent over the CES letter. Brandy had a family member send her Mormon Think website. And so we kind of just were at this point where we looked at each other like, are we going to do this? Are we going to go down this rabbit hole, or do we stay in this safe zone?
And that's a scary place to be, right? Because you're not supposed to look into this kind of stuff. This is anti-Mormon type stuff. So even just doing that is a little bit of a, I mean, did you feel a little bit disobedient?
It feels dirty. Yeah. It feels dirty. It feels wrong.
You feel awful. You feel like you've lost the Holy Ghost because you have these feelings that
your stomach, you know, turns upside down and you go, well, this is the Spirit warning me to not look at this because you know, it's not going to bring good feelings.
Yep.
Well, I think we're going to have to cover that in the next episode, because I don't want to cut your story short. And there's so much more I want to hear about. And so let's leave it at this for this episode. It's kind of a cliffhanger for next week. So I'm going to encourage our listeners to come back next week to hear the rest of the story of Brandy and AJ. And guys, I can't wait. Thank you for coming on and sharing this part of your story. And I can't wait to hear more of it next week.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening. If you haven't already, please consider rating our podcast. It's a simple way to help us reach more people. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.